Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. Commodities are one of those asset classes advisors and investors know they should understand better, but often don't. Too volatile, too cyclical, too hard to time, and too often they're approached as tactical trades rather than strategic portfolio tools. But underneath the noise, we're seeing real structural pressures: energy, geopolitics, electrification, supply constraints in copper, renewed interest in precious metals, not as trades, but as reflections of a world that's become less stable and more resource constrained. Tony Dong, founder of ETF Portfolio Blueprint, is my guest, back on the show for the third time. In his work at ETF Portfolio Blueprint, he's built up a solid reputation for providing authoritative analysis and a commitment to educating retail investors, specializing in simplifying complex financial subjects into engaging and actionable content in both the US and Canadian ETF marketplaces. Tony has most recently been digging into the commodity complex from the ETF practitioner's seat, looking not just at commodities broadly, but at how specific exposures behave, how ETFs actually deliver that exposure, and where investors often get the story wrong. Today, we're going to pressure test the common narratives, starting with the straw man view of commodities, then working through what the data actually shows, and ending with how advisors and investors might think about both narrow and broad commodity exposure more deliberately. Tony, welcome. It is great to have you back.
It's good to be back.
I've been looking forward to our conversation, and looking over some of your recent work, I thought we thought commodities would be a really great subject to dive into with you. Tony, there's this sort of pervasive view, for as long as I can remember anyways, that commodities are just volatile trading tools. That's sort of like the writ large view that you generally hear. The common advisor view is that commodities are noisy, cyclical, and best left to traders, not long-term portfolios. Where do you think this view breaks down first? Like, when you actually look at energy, copper, or precious metals individually rather than as, you know, a broad diversified commodity exposure?
Yeah, so it comes from, like, and full like, you know, condolences to the advisors, is just an incomplete understanding of how volatility and correlation overlap. An asset that is volatile in and of itself is not necessarily a bad fit for the component if it possesses a structurally low correlation to the rest of your assets. So if you have something that's zigging and zagging over the place, but it goes up and down differently than stocks and bond does, then when you pair them together and rebalance, you know, the math of modern portfolio theory tells us that you can harvest a tangible rebalancing premium. And I think that a lot of advisors have this view because historically how you've been able to access commodities has been subpar. It's generally been futures-based funds, which, due to the intricacies of the future markets and the futures curve, you suffer something called negative roll yield. For instance, if you're long crude oil using futures and you hold the front month right now, January 2026 future, by the time it comes time to roll your exposure over to February 2026, that future is usually trading at a price higher than the current commodity oil spot price. And what happens is you're structurally selling low and buying high, and that leads to what we call negative roll yield. But commodity exposure has advanced thanks to ETFs to a point where it's not only extremely cheap, but you can do much more than just eat contango from rolling the same front month future. And we're going to talk about a few options after that. So my advice to advisors here, as ironic as that sounds, is look at portfolio level contributions to risk and return, not in and of itself. Yes, I know the standard deviation is high. Try sizing it up at 10-20% of that allocation and rebalance it. You'd be surprised at what it can do.
Yeah. Well, that's just it, right? They march to a different drummer. Let's dive into energy ETFs first for a moment. Like, there's this view that you know, energy ETFs are a geopolitical thing, but there's also the fundamentals, right? Energy exposure often gets dismissed as a geopolitical gamble. It's too dependent on OPEC headlines or regime changes. In your Canadian energy ETF work, how much of the return profile is geopolitics, and how much of it is actually balance sheets, capital discipline, and structural underinvestment?
I'm with Eric Newton on this one. It's mostly the later. The geopolitical headlines, they're short-term things. They're going to affect it. But if you look at what's actually driving, and we're going to talk about Canadian exporters and producers, so upstream. It's, as you mentioned, balance sheet, cash flow. A lot of these, especially some natural gas producers like Tourmaline, they're trading at historically high free cash flow yields. They very much understand the average Canadian energy executive, one of the big upstream ones like CNQ or Suncor, they know they're in the depletion business. They know that it's about managing reserves, keeping all-in sustaining costs, to borrow a term from, you know, gold mining, low. Now, some of these are profitable with crude oil prices down below $50, which I think is just shows how much more resilient they've gotten, right? I know that a lot of people are still spooked by what happened during COVID with oil prices going negative, but it doesn't change the fundamentals that if you ignore the volatility, just the day-to-day, you know, the securities being marked up and down to market based on trader sentiment, is that year over year, these companies are in a position to return a lot of yield to shareholders, whether through opportunistic buybacks or special dividends, right? And one of the other things I want to highlight in the Canadian energy sector has been the M&A trend. They know that a bigger balance sheet is essential for surviving a depletion business. And that's why you have a profile of the energy industry where it's a big hump of mega caps and large caps and a long tail of scrappy up-and-coming explorers. But as soon as they get to that mid-cap range, they get bought out. And sometimes we see mergers of equals, like with Whitecap and Vereen, but a lot of the time it's someone with capital coming in opportunistically and taking that over to gain access to new resources. Because again, depletion industry, if you start from the understanding that oil is finite, there's a limited amount we can extract, it's going to get more and more expensive to explore resources and open up new markets over time. So the best we can do is optimize our business for efficiency and return cash to shareholders. That makes energy investing, I think, a lot easier to think about for the long term and stick to versus, oh my God, I got to trade in and out of the latest headline like Venezuela. That's just noise.
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody who's been following Eric Nuttall, his analysis on oil and the regular updates at Nine Point, will get that message. I mean, that it's not just, you know, reacting to the headlines, this year's, you know, opening news with Venezuela. It's really still about looking at how are these companies actually running their business? What are they doing to maximize efficiency? And, you know, I love the way Eric has of, you know, showing, okay, this is what happens when oil's in the 50s. Here's what happens if it goes to 70. I mean, we're not talking about oil hitting a home run or being concerned about oil, you know, reaching 90 or 100. A lot of these companies that are, for example, in his portfolios have actually figured out the math and how to optimize for their own, you know, productivity, their own profitability as well. And many of these companies are in a position, like if we're looking at oil equities, you know, are in a position to buy back their stock hand over fist. And you know, that adds to the oil equity story versus, you know, the oil commodity story itself. And so, you know, you're looking at some very interesting opportunities in that space, this, you know, regardless of the geopolitics.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and in many ways, the energy industry has been the opposite of the U.S. industrial industry, where we saw a lot of inefficiencies during the conglomerate era, where they were obsessed with accretive acquisitions and growing EPS synthetically. Whereas oil companies, like, really the basics, right? How can we maximize unit economics? How do we, like, stress test our well reserve life and assess the viability of new deposits? And how do we navigate? You know, I think that's changing now with the new government, but in the past, how do we navigate an unfriendly political environment and intra-provincial politics? So it's been a rough time for them. Absolutely, it's been a hard journey, but I think we're at the point right now where not only is the macro environment favorable, but the unit economics and the fundamentals have been strong for quite a bit. And there won't be that point where that crosses and investors wake up and these things reprice and they're no longer trading at 10 times forward earnings, maybe 15, 20.
As a diversifier in a portfolio, they're not behaving like the rest of the equity complex. Fundamentally, the energy complex, the oil complex, at least oil and natural gas complex, can be can become a very exciting asymmetric trade, as well as an ongoing diversifier as things unfold. Let's talk about copper for a sec. I know you've done some recent work with Global X in particular. Copper is everyone knows about copper. It's the trade that still gets misunderstood, right? Copper is widely described as the electrification metal, yet many investors still treat it as a cyclical China proxy, right? What's the most misunderstood assumption investors are making about copper and copper ETFs, especially when it comes to supply timelines versus demand narratives?
Yeah, so that's where the difference between oil is. Whereas Canadian oil, I am apt to just ignore geopolitics entirely.
Yeah.
For copper, you absolutely have to consider geopolitics because of three things. The first one are the multi-year electrification and decarbonization mandates from some of the biggest superpowers in the world. You have the United States, Europe, and China. And copper is the bottleneck commodity in all of this. Across mines around the world, we're seeing declining ore grades, frequent supply disruptions, whether due to nationalizations or conflicts, and what people don't understand is you can't just go up and open a mine the next day in Peru. There is a decade-long lead time to get a mine going. And the second is that, yes, while China is forecasted to have a very high refined copper consumption, it's not the only emerging market country. You know, from the research I reviewed from S&P Global, Vietnam is projected to match that by 2050. Right. And Vietnam is one of those economies right now where you can, like, short of one ETF from VanEck on the US side, you cannot invest in. It's actually classified as a frontier market. So right. One more step removed from emerging. And if you add in Mexico and India cumulatively, it essentially matches China. So even if we see a small bump in electricity consumption, not just EV adoption, just electricity consumption, that could translate to a lot of copper demand. And the final thing is that I want to tie back to copper being a strategic metal, one that countries, for better or worse, are going to fight over. Whether, you know, I'm not talking about direct conflict, but just jockeying through tariffs, through trade agreements, through PACs and whatever. That's it. Because supply in copper is heavily concentrated. If you look at who dominates global production, Canada has a robust mining industry, so does the US, but the deposits are in Chile, Peru, China, Russia, and the Congo. Very few of these countries are actually open to Canadian investment. China now, maybe with the new trade agreements we have just signed, but the rest of them are very much those BRICS countries, and they're vulnerable to political instability, permitting delays, and trade. The US is already trying to diversify supply chains and supply long-term contracts. And I think that Canada should be doing the same here, because this all converges into one outcome, a wide long-term deficit against higher demand for copper.
And what are your thoughts on how investors should approach the exposure to copper? Like, is that, you know, the commodity or copper equities or both?
You can do both. For direct copper exposure, Sprott has a closed-ended copper fund, and it works essentially the other way they do. It holds copper in actual physical storage. It's audited. Each share gives you fractional, but because it's a closed-ended trust, the price that which you buy at can either be higher, so a premium, or lower, a discount versus its at net asset value. And that's entirely driven by sentiment and flows. Obviously, no one likes buying at a premium, but one thing you have to realize is that discounts may never narrow, if ever, right? So if you're going to go the physical copper route using this, look for something called the Z score. It's something that's calculated for closed-ended funds, and it tells you the relative degree to which a discount has been versus historical measures or premium, whatever. It's a good way to say, okay, right. Well, it's at a discount, but how much of a discount is it at? And you got to ask, you know, what's the reason for this, right?
Right.
If you opt for equities, one thing to note is that miners have operating leverage. And what this means is that if you think about how a miner works, they operate under fixed costs to build a mine, to get permits, even hiring is somewhat fixed, but the price at which they sell the copper at varies based on the spot price. So what happens is if you have fixed costs but variable sales prices, that translates during a bull market into a much higher profitability, and that's an effective operating leverage. And what happens when you get margin expansion, you have earnings expansion, then you have multiple expansions. So instead of trading for, say, 10 times earning, all of a sudden these are trading for 15, 20 times earning. And that's why we've seen during historical trends, I'm looking at the Bloomberg Copper Sub-Index, which is a futures-based index. From 2020 to now, some major copper equity producers like Southern Copper and Freeport-McMoRan have strongly outperformed this. Of course, they're not pure play copper, but that just goes to show you how that margin and multiple expansion can help you get higher returns than the spot metal itself. But it's going to hurt you on the downside too. And mathematically, a 10% drawdown takes an 11% gain to break even. So I would say it's less advantageous if you're not of the conviction that we're about to see a copper super cycle.
What are your thoughts on that?
There's been more super cycle call than I could see. And frankly, I don't know enough whether to comment on it. My view on copper is I think we spoke about this before the podcast started, but it's kind of like a cascading effect. You know, the whole debasement trade idea that started in 2024 is only being accelerated now with what we're seeing the U.S. doing with Venezuela and Greenland. While it may not seem like it, I think investors are losing faith in the U.S. dollar. And they've just been working their way down the list of commodities. We started with gold. Now silver is squeezing. Now we're at copper. What's next? Nickel, zinc, palladium, platinum? I don't know. But there's essentially an ETF for each of these minus nickel and zinc. Actually, Sprott has a nickel miners ETF. So there you go. Like, investors are hunting for new ways to express real asset exposures, and issuers are indulging them. And I think that there is a self-reinforcing cycle here, which is precisely why I'm reluctant to call it a super cycle, because a super cycle implies that there is a structural change long term. I think there is a structural change for copper. I am just not certain that it will persist into the future because of how complex the geopolitical picture is. Right, I didn't see Canada signing a trade agreement with China last year, but it just happened, right? And these are all things that could meaningfully affect the trajectory of how this goes. So I can't call it, because frankly, I'm going to come out and say I don't know enough, and I'm not going to give you an uneducated answer here.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, speaking of China, I know, you know, that's the common perception, is that China has been a big driver of as an importer of copper, but In the last number of years, China has been stockpiling, among other things, copper, nickel. They've been stockpiling, grains. They've been stockpiling anything to do with military, any military spending, defense spending, almost as though they're preparing for war.
They are. The world is heading towards a multipolarized reality, and China is at war. You look at the border conflicts with India, where there have been casualties. Did you know that they limit themselves to just melee weapons? They don't use guns. They fight each other with clubs and other medieval implements to limit casualties and prevent it from spilling over. But there's very much violence happening across the periphery of China. The people think that they're going to look at Taiwan with what the U.S. just did in Venezuela and Russia with Ukraine. Now on day 1,422. The world is being carved into three spheres. And to quote 1984, you have Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia. Take your pick. What people don't realize is that they see China's allocation in the global equity ETF at 10%, less than that. They're like, okay, it's not a big deal. But by GDP, not by market capitalization, China is number two, right? For a 2025 projected GDP growth for China is 4.8% versus 2% for the U.S., the total GDP for the U.S. is 30.60 trillion. For China, it's 19.4 trillion. They're catching up. And I think it's something to be concerned about, because they have what they believe is their sphere of influence across the Chinese Ocean, across the periphery countries. And if you look at it as superpowers and city states, it makes a lot more sense where you think they're going to head next, whether by gold or by steel. Take your pick. It's been the case since history immemorial. And I think people forget that the relative peace we've enjoyed post-World War II is an anomaly, not the norm.
Yeah. I mean, China in particular has a long history, 1800 years before the last 200 years of sort of ruling the world economy.
Oh, yeah. Well, people forget that China, went through a very, the last dynasty in China, the Qin dynasty, was very weak, and then fractioned into regionalism and warlords, and then you had the nationalists face off against the communists. So, like, if you think about, like, I saw a joke here where it's like, okay, like, you see, like, a Wikipedia article about China, like, the Great Leap Forward, it seems inconspicuous, and you read the fine print, it's like millions of people died, right?
Yeah.
That country is operating on a scale at which the U.S., while it's managed to reach that through rapid post-war industrialization, doesn't have the number of years of history backing it, right?
Yeah.
The modern Chinese one can be traced back to the end of the civil war between the nationalists and the communists, but it's drawn on thousands of years of history. So, and this is a very homogenous country, right? Like 92% of them are what, Han Chinese, right? With like a couple dozen other minorities. So they're able to present a united front in ways, coincidentally, during a time where the U.S. is becoming more and more factionalized. I would even call what's happening in the U.S. right now self-balkanization. You know, you have mass federal agents in certain states that are definitely unfriendly to the regime. Like, what else would I call it? You know, it's important to acknowledge these things happening because, we are living through these times, and it pays to be prepared.
It's painful to watch.
It is.
It's painful to watch. It's
history. It's always happened.
You know, looking at you know, China and thinking, you know, as part of their own national pride as a civilization, you can't help thinking, you know, this is firmly part of their mindset, which is, you know, the dominance, the world dominance factor. You can't underestimate it. It's not that they're...
And every country wants that. Some are more explicit with it than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's you can call it nationalism, you can call it xenophobia. I think it's just when people are feeling crowded for resources and living space, they tend to band together with like-minded people that look the same and advance the same goals at the population level. And that's a fancy way of saying that people are very factional, people are very territorial, and this multicultural quilt that we take for granted in Canada and benefit from is not the norm elsewhere. So if we want, not to get political here, but if we want to preserve this, we got to consciously think about the advantages that it gives us versus just saying, oh, I'm Chinese Canadian, I'm Indian Canadian or something. It's about finding common ground here, because if we don't, we're surrounded by a bigger country with a bigger military who's now trying to get our north and box us in. Like, it's not a good place to be. So Canadians have to present a united front right now. Sorry, are we on a finance podcast or?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, like when you stop and consider, you know, what's going on, like even this, you know, Venezuela insurrection that happened, capture of Maduro, bringing him back and you know, making it all about narco traffic instead of what it's actually really all about. I think the superficial story, of course, is that it's about, you know, redeveloping Venezuela because of its massive oil reserves.
It's always about petrochemicals. It's always been about petroleum.
But the interesting part of it is that it might not be so much about getting the oil for the U.S. or for the Western Hemisphere. It's about not allowing that oil to be delivered to China or Iran, right, or any other, you know.
Well, you heard about the shadow tanker fleet they had with Russia, right? Yeah. You know, when you look at geopolitics, asset denial is as valid of an objective as asset seizure, right? If I can't have it for myself to benefit from it, the least I can do is deny it to the constituents of my opponent. All right. And I think people would do well to take a real politic take to this and just cast aside the feelings, cast aside the morals, cast aside the virtues. It's all about dollars and power. Right. And
yeah, you really have to stop and look at it agnostically. Analytically.
We share the longest undefended border with a now unfriendly regime that has made unveiled threats about not only annexing us, but also interfering our politics with what's going on in Alberta right now and our energy markets, and also expressed an interest to take over an island, it's Greenland.
Yeah,
it's an island, but it's a sovereign country that is essential to our Arctic security, and that we have forged deep ties with other North Atlantic Treaty Organization members to ensure its collective security. that's what we're dealing with right now. And, you know, there are still some people who believe that this is all going to resolve itself, that 100 years of shared history. Again, that is the exception, not the norm. It's all gone now. Whatever the past presidents have done, it doesn't matter. For the next 3 years, this is what we're locked into. And this is the kind of reality you have to come around to accept. And long after Trump is gone, in the next 100 years, after you and I are dust, there will be someone else like him. The same archetype, the same nationalistic, authoritarian mindset. It gets passed down through history. Just people fail to recognize it.
Very concerning. Tony, let's shift gears for a minute. I want to talk about silver and gold. And first of all, the false equivalency fallacy. And secondly, the idea that precious metals often get treated as interchangeable inflation hedges. When you compare silver and gold ETFs structurally, industrial demand, volatility, ETF construction, what differences actually matter most for portfolio use?
Correlation. It's all about correlation. So it varies between the time frame you're looking at. I like looking at rolling correlations on a monthly basis over 3, 5, and 10 year periods. But generally, if you're going to use gold or silver as a diversifier, pick the one with the lower correlation to stocks and bonds in the aggregate. And historically, that's been gold. And the structural reason I can come up with that is that it's the only one that's stockpiled by central banks as an asset. Yeah, there's some use for, there's some stockpiling of silver, but the majority of it is for industrial applications in photovoltaic cells, you know, in electronics, in catalytic converters and all that stuff.
Totally different driver.
Yeah, vastly different driver. You have industrial drivers there. And as you know, industrial drivers are subject to industrial cycles, and industrial cycles play a large part in the economy. So what you've done is you've really just layered on some additional equity risk in a way. So that's why my preference goes to gold. Central banks stockpile for a reason. They're not stupid. They do that for a very reason. One of the criticisms I would like to address is that people often criticize Canada for selling off its gold reserves. Like, we don't need gold reserves. We mine it. We're one of the biggest miners of gold. We can take it out of the earth at low fixed costs whenever we want. You know? There's no real need there. And if it really came down to it, I'm sure the Canadian government can nationalize Barrick. It would cause a lot of uproar. But hey, you know what? In the grand scheme of things, the U.S. has confiscated gold before. Right?
Yeah.
It's just one of those things where we should really be looking at history for some examples there. So back to the question. Gold is a diversifier all around. Silver, much more speculative. And frankly, I haven't even followed the recent silver pump. I look at it as just silver bugs finally getting their day in the court.
Yeah. But what I mean, you mentioned different drivers for silver. What are the, some of those drivers for silver? Like, industrial uses, obviously, are the big one. What do you think the outlook for, like, if you're comparing the two metals, and two precious metals, gold is a much better diversifier, has a much more quantifiable history as that, and because of the central bank involvement. But where do you see, like, I think people are looking at both of these markets and thinking same driver, but they're not, right?
They're like, not
is,
not at all.
Is there a structural case for, like, there's a structural case for copper, there's a structural case for oil to some degree. Is there any structural case for silver, for example?
There is, but it's been absolutely destroyed by recency bias, that part. And it goes towards the energy transition. Like it or not, the lot outside of the US, the climate targets are still a thing. You know, electrification mandates are still a thing. Silver is essential for solar panels, especially the newer ones, and electrical vehicles as well. They're also used in advanced semiconductors, data center, and 5G infrastructure, and various hypoallergenic coatings for medical devices. Right? So there's an innovation angle to silver that often gets discounted. And I don't blame it, because, look, you have the narrative of clean energy electrification. On one side, you have Chinese demand. That is the biggest near-term one. And then you have the Trump administration rolling back on climate goals. So the real long-term structural driver, the one that's not sexy, one that's not going to soar overnight, but it's going to be a steady, like, baseline, is getting discounted a lot. Frankly, right now, I think that prices have run ahead of what they're worth.
Right.
But If I was to bet on silver, it would be under this thesis, not the China one, not the debasement one, but rather in one from a technological innovation angle.
We've covered some of the key commodities and ETFs that are getting a lot more attention these days. What are your thoughts on broad commodity exposure?
If you're using them as a satellite allocation of portfolio to rebalance periodically without relying on a single driver of commodity growth, like, you know, if you're a long gold, you're long central bank reserves, essentially, I think don't make sense there. But the key, again, is to avoid contango. One of the other reasons to use a Canadian commodity ETF is that a lot of the U.S. ones are structured as partnerships, right? They're not RICs. They're not governed under the Investment Act of 1940. They are publicly traded partnerships. So what happens with these is if you own them as a Canadian, you're at tax time in December. You're going to get what's called a Schedule K-1. And that reports your share as a partner of the ETF's income and losses. However, that gives you a U.S. tax reporting obligation. The IRS wants you to file. You get a USTIN and stuff. It is a huge pain in the butt. Using the Canadian one, and you don't have to worry about that. So that's another reason to stay at home for your commodity ETF if you're going to get one.
What's your view on commodities, either narrow or broad, as a diversifier?
So if you use a narrow ETF, it's better. And for commodities, I would almost say go for the narrow one, right? Go for the one that you understand, which you have time to follow, that is backed by long-term structural drivers. I love gold because the central bank buying essentially gives you a level of support, to quote the technical analysis folks, right? There's so much gold in China's coffers, in the U.S., in Fort Knox, supposedly. There's so much we can dig out of the ground in our hills here that it's here to stay. So my vote will go to gold. I go with narrow commodities just because it's easier to understand. And when you understand something, you're more likely to stay the course when it doesn't go the way you expect.
What an awesome conversation.
I mean, yeah, it kind of went off the tangent a few more times.
I think for any readers listening out there is that, you know, if you're investing, if you're going to be actively investing, that is, you're not just dollar cost averaging into some Vanguard index fund and letting it ride, which is perfectly valid, by the way.
Yeah.
Just not a lot of people can stick to it. If you're going to be actively monitoring portfolio, start paying attention to politics. Yeah, it makes me feel uncomfortable. I hate doing it too. I hate reading politics. But like you or not, these are going to affect moves in your portfolio, your net worth, and also the future regulations that determine how you're able to grow said network, right? Your portfolio doesn't operate in a vacuum. And when big players are making moves behind the scenes, it pays to pay attention.
Tony, thank you very much for your incredibly valuable time, your analysis, and your insight.
Anytime.
Great catching up with you.